From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with a diverse array of voices who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival and Conference, at our year-round events, and in up-to-the-minute interviews. This week, On Story brings you a discussion with Brian Helgeland on the 20th anniversary of the release of L.A. Confidential, for which he won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay.
I think the thing about the book that I was most attracted to was the Bud White character that Russell Crowe plays in the movie. It was because he's a guy who no one thinks he's a detective. He knows deep down inside he's a detective, and no one thinks he's a detective. And I related to that really strongly.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week, On Story brings you a discussion with Brian Helgeland on the 20th anniversary of the release of L.A. Confidential. Among the films Brian Helgeland has written and directed are Legend, 42, A Knight's Tale, and Payback. As a screenwriter, his credits include Man on Fire, The Taking of Pelham 123, Conspiracy Theory, Green Zone, Bloodwork, and Mystic River, for which he received an Academy Award nomination. Helgeland won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for his work on L.A. Confidential. He is also the recipient of the Writers Guild of America Award, the Edgar Allan Poe Award, and the Sidney Lumet Award for Integrity in Entertainment. Clips from this episode copyright Monarchy Enterprises, BV and Regency Entertainment, and Columbia Pictures Industries, Inc.
Come to Los Angeles. The sun shines bright. The beaches are wide and inviting, and the orange grove stretches far as the eye can see. There are jobs aplenty, and land is cheap. Every working man can have his own house, and inside every house, a happy all-American family. You can have all this, and who knows? You could even be discovered, become a movie star, or at least see one. Life is good in Los Angeles. It's paradise on earth. That's what they tell you, anyway.
I was a big admirer of James Ellroy, and he had written this series of pulpy books called the Lloyd Hopkins books, which were L.A. homicide detective, and 200 pages long, and you followed him around, and they were kind of just paperback books, but they were really well written, and I read all of them and thought they were great. And this was in the late 80s, and I was writing horror films. I had done Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and I had done a film called 976 Evil, and I was anxious to move on from that. I first met James because he had a book signing, The Big Nowhere had come out, which was his first, I think, really well-received book. And a big step up from these Lloyd Hopkins books. And he had a book signing on Hollywood Boulevard, and I think it was 1988. And I went to it, and there were four people there, and just empty. And I talked to him a lot afterwards. And one of these Lloyd Hopkins books had been made into the movie Cop. The book was called Blood on the Moon, but they had made it into this movie Cop, which he hated. And I equally hated because it strayed so far from his book, which I had read, which I really liked. And we talked about that, and I commiserated with him, and he basically was wondering who the hell I was, I think. And he signed my book, and that was it. And I thought, I've now seen what a real writer looks like, and it's not me. And a couple of years went by, and L.A. Confidential came out, and Warner's bought it. David Wolper bought it to make a TV miniseries out of it. And I thought that was... I read it, and I thought that was interesting. I didn't know how they, with the language and everything, and it was still all network television, and I didn't know how they were going to pull it off. But it was in that time period where it was very kind of, you're either a movie writer or a TV writer, and I was a movie writer, so I had I just thought, I hope it goes well, and that was it. And they tried for a couple of years to make a miniseries out of it, and nothing ever happened with it. And I think they realized they couldn't do it for TV, so David decided to try to make a film out of it. And Warner's put out, sort of on their open writing assignments, LA Confidential. My agent knew how much I liked Elroy, and she started to try to get me a job. I mean, she started trying to get me in for a meeting to pitch how I would do it, to get hired to adapt the book. And I couldn't get a meeting, and it was always, he's a horror movie writer, or he writes cheesy action movies, whatever box they had me in at that time, either one of those two boxes. And I couldn't get a meeting, but I kept persevering, and they didn't hire anyone, And she finally got me a meeting, and on the morning of the meeting, and I had my pitch all prepared, my half-hour pitch of how I would do it, they called her, and they said that they had hired someone the day before, and so my meeting was canceled. And it was Curtis Hanson they had hired. Curtis was at the same agency as me, so my agent started to lobby him to meet me. I couldn't get a meeting at Warner's, and finally Curtis agreed to meet me, I think mostly because he was bemused by this kind of assault on his phone sheet or whatever it was. He was in post-production, I think, on The River Wild, and he was cutting it at Universal in this bungalow, and he knew the whole history of the bungalow and what directors had been in it for the last 40 years and what films had posted there, what films had prepped there. He knew everything about it. And about 6 months later, it got torn down because they were expanding the ride at Universal, so they tore the building down. But he was a big fan of Hollywood history, like a historian, really, you know. And he had a very long road to get to where he was. He had just done The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, but he had done horror films for Roger Corman. The Dunwich Horror, I think, is one, and I forget the other one. And that's how he started out. So he had, when I explained who I was, he had an immediate kind of fondness for me. And I think he saw his younger self in me to some extent. Like I said, he knew Hollywood history inside out, and deep down he wanted to be part of Hollywood history, which he would never admit, and which he hadn't done anything up to that point that would get him there. I'll always remember he had a Mission-style chair that he had just had reupholstered in his office, and it was rock hard. And so he said, sit in that chair and pitch me how you do it. Because he was trying to break the chair in. So at least I wouldn't waste his time. I could pitch, but I could start breaking the chair in at the same time. And I pitched him my pitch for LA Confidential, and it was, it's so complicated, the novel. I mean, for example, in the novel, there are two serial killers on the loose in the novel. Not one, but two. And in the movie, there's none because we just couldn't service it. You know, we couldn't deal with it. But the novel's tremendous, and I wanted to be true to the themes in the novel. And the way I attacked it was I just said that there was the three main characters, Exley, Bud White, and Vincenz. And I said any scene that doesn't have at least one of them in it is immediately thrown out of the book. And once we have all that, then we'll see where all the holes are and where things don't make sense anymore and try to start having it make sense again. And it was basically similar to what Curtis was thinking. He was in post and he couldn't start right away on the script. So he said, well, why don't you start? You'll get the job. I'll hire you to do this with me. And you start. And then when I'm done posting River Wild, then I'll come in. And that's how we got started. And by the end of it all, that chair was completely broken in. I think there was a lot of rewriting in LA Confidential because it was so unwieldy and we were always trying to find ways to bring it down. And I hadn't rewritten a lot. You know, I'd kind of write a script and that was it. It was done. And, it, you know, there's that saying about writing is rewriting. And I hadn't really done a lot of that. And LA Confidential was written over and over and over again. I think we did 15 drafts of it, partly because we were always trying to get it manageable, get it down to 127 pages or whatever it ended up being, from drafts that were 170 and 160 and 150. but also because the studio kept saying they didn't want to make it. Every time we turned in a draft, they didn't want to make it, to the point where they wouldn't pay me anymore to write drafts. And Curtis was dogged. He said to me, basically, you know, we're not going to get paid, but every time we turn in a new draft, they're going to have to say no. And it's going to be on their radar again, and they're going to have to look at it again. And that was, it took quite a bit for me to say, okay, well, let's do that. You know, but that's what we did. And we'd send it in, and they'd say no, and we'd send it in, and they'd say no. And that tenacity of rewriting and representing, which sounds maybe a little bit odd, but it's just to get his ability to get the studio to never stop paying attention was very impressive. And he believed in it, you know, he believed in it and got me sort of realizing what you have to do and go through if you believe in something. Well, the studio, it was Warner Brothers, and they just couldn't see it as a film. And because it was such an ensemble, it didn't have, Warner's was at that time making a lot of films that had a main character, made a lot of movies in that kind of tone, but it was always one man up against something. And this had three protagonists and a very convoluted plot line. And it was a period piece. And Curtis was very much wanting to cast unknowns because the audience would buy into it quicker and they wouldn't have to think, you know, here's Bruce Willis running around in a period costume and all that kind of stuff. So it was partly not commercial in their eyes, but it was also the way he wanted to do it wasn't particularly commercial either. And eventually we shamed them into putting it into turnaround, which means we get the script back. And if we could get it going somewhere else, they'd reimburse Warner Brothers for the money they spent developing it, and we could try to make it somewhere else. So they said, yeah, take it somewhere else. And we took it to Arnon Milchan at New Regency, who really liked it and almost immediately said, I'm in, I want to do it. And the joke was that he financed it, but his distribution deal for film was Warner Brothers. So he made the movie and then gave it back to Warner Brothers. So it was like a bad penny that Warner Brothers couldn't get rid of, and they ended up releasing it. And I'm sure to this day, it's one of the films in the last 20 years that they're very proud to have quote unquote made, you know? So, that's how it went. There was an executive at Warner Brothers the night before the Academy Awards who called me up and said, don't forget to say my name if you win and thank me. And I said, you have to be kidding me. You have to be kidding me. And you can look up my acceptance speech on YouTube, but I don't say his name in my speech.
Filmmaker Brian Helgeland, looking back on his Oscar-winning crime thriller L.A. Confidential 20 years after its release. For more On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with filmmaker Brian Helgeland remarking on L.A. Confidential author James Ellroy's impression and involvement with the film adaptation of his celebrated novel.
He knew we were working on it, but he didn't know us. He obviously didn't remember, you know, retroactively meeting me years ago in a book signing. And Curtis wanted to stay away from him and not involve him until we had a script that we were happy with. Finally, we decided this is a script we're happy with, and we sent it off to him, and we got summoned to the Pacific Dining Car downtown, which is one of the locations in the film, which was a big cop hangout. I think it still is, but in the 50s and 40s, it was a very big cop hangout. And I was terrified, not of him. I was terrified that he wouldn't like it, because it kind of, all that work would be down the drain to me if he didn't like it. He told us right away, he said, it's my book, it's your movie, so I wrote my book. I'm not going to have anything to do with this film. And but he said, I think the script, you know, there's things I miss, but I think that the script is thematically intact to the book. And what I learned over the years with, if you do a book adaptation, that if the author, you can change all kinds of things, but if the theme and the characters are still the same, the authors are generally happy. It's when you change what the book's about that you get a very angry author on your hands. I thought that if Elroy didn't like the script, that I basically wouldn't know how to carry on, because I had so much respect for him and admiration. And at that point in my life, he was a bit of a hero, writing hero for me. So if he had said, this is garbage, I don't know what I would have done. The other thing about Elroy was he had announced that it was unadaptable, that LA Confidential was unadaptable. He had said a quote somewhere when someone asked him about the movie rights. And he very proudly said that I have written a novel that is completely and utterly unadaptable. So that was good too. So the script was a little bit like Lazarus, kind of, you know, it was dead and it had to be raised up again. And I started to look at it because it took us 3 years from when we started to when we started shooting. And I used to think of it as my purgatory script, that I was paying some penance for some sin, that I would forever be right. I had died and gone to purgatory, and I would, for the rest of my existence, be writing LA Confidential over and over and over again. And I did other scripts simultaneously, and a couple of those went right off and started, you know, being made. One of them was Conspiracy Theory, but LA Confidential was stubborn, but like I said, I just thought, this is, when I stop working on this, I'll be less of a writer because I'll have given up. And that was, Curtis instilled that in a lot of ways. I think the thing about the book that I was most attracted to was the Bud White character Russell Crowe plays in the movie. It was because he's a guy who is like a thug, and they bring him in to scare suspects and beat him up. And at some point in the movie and the book, he says, I'm just the guy they bring in to scare the other guy. And no one thinks he's a detective. He knows deep down inside he's a detective, and no one thinks he's a detective. And I related to that really strongly as a writer, thinking no one would hire me to do this. Everyone thinks I'm a horror movie writer. And I know I can do it, but I just can't get the chance. And him going through this whole movie and then kind of giving himself the chance by sticking to it and everything, I very much related to that. And I think Curtis oddly related to the Jack Vincennes character, the Kevin Spacey character, because he's a Hollywood cop who's never part of Hollywood, but he's on the fringes of Hollywood, and he's always has little tastes of it and little experiences of it, but he's never part of it. And I think Curtis very much felt that way in his career up to that point, which had been, you know, a lot of very well-made films, but B-films and thrillers and things like that. And so he related to, neither of us related to Exley, we related to Vincennes and Bud White. So I think that helped us a lot along the way. Once we got a green light once we got the financing and we had the Arnon Milchan on board and everything, and we knew we were making the film, and Curtis started to cast it. And I didn't really have much to do with that. Once in a while, he'd show me a casting session tape and ask me what I thought, but I didn't have a lot to do with it. But I did, you know, he did tell me stories about it, and he was very keen on Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce for the two of the three cops. And they were basically, Russell had a little bit of exposure. He had done the film Romper Stomper in Australia, and he was thought of as someone to watch. But Guy was unknown, and he got a lot of resistance from producers on that, including one producer who said, you can't cast both of them because they look so much alike, I can't tell them apart. So if you want to just look at a picture of the two of them side by side, you'd wonder how that could be. But he was, you know, he was convinced that in this kind of period piece, this world he was trying to sell, he wanted to be able to have the leads be someone you immediately accept. And the way to do that is that they don't associate him with anything else. So if you had Mel Gibson play Bud White, everyone would be, it would take him 10 minutes to get over that it's the guy from Lethal Weapon, that kind of thing. The way Curtis was able to get around that was by casting Kevin Spacey, who had done Usual Suspects, and he had done Seven, and everyone knew who he was, and Danny DeVito, and to fill out the cast that way with recognizable faces and things so that this, they'd start to feel more comfortable about it. And the budget was, it was a low budget, so it was... It wasn't too huge a chance for everyone to take financially. Once we had most of the cast, we began rehearsals for about 3 weeks. You know, I forget the name of the church, but it was on Hollywood Boulevard. They had a hall attached to the church, and we rented the hall out. And we had table readings, and we'd all go through it. And then scenes between Russell and Guy, they'd go through. And we just talk it all through. And Curtis was... there as a, you know, the leader and the moderator of the whole thing, and I'd be there writing down notes. A screenplay is a theoretical exercise in a lot of ways. You know, things that sound good in your head don't sound good sometimes when they're said out loud. Or just when you get two actors in a room going back and forth, you know, it reveals things and it adds things. So we went through it for about 3 weeks, and all the little things that came out of that we then incorporated into a final draft, including the shootout at the end, which is a shootout, you know, that's theoretical. And what we did in this church hall is we moved all the chairs out, and then we put up all these chairs back in to create a kind of diagram of what the motel would be like. And Russell was laying on the floor with chairs on top of him to see if he could really pull himself up out of the hole from the crawl space scene that's at the end of the film and stuff like that, and he could, so it was like, all right, the crawl space works and things like that. So even the action action scene was very written. It's very laid out on paper, all the moves and how it plays out and all that kind of thing, and that came out of what we had plus the rehearsal. My favorite moment in the film is what I kind of always knew was going to be my favorite moment of the film, and that's when Russell tells Kim Basinger that everyone thinks he's an idiot, but he's not. He's smart, and he can be a detective. And it's a very, very quiet scene. I think they're in bed, and it's the softest and most gentle he is in the entire movie.
Is that why you became a cop? To get even?
Maybe.
Do you like it?
I used to. Oh, it's all strong arm sitting duck stuff. I mean, if I could get a chance to work homicide like a real detective. That actually, he shot the wrong guys. Whoever killed Stensland is still around. I know it in here. I know it. There's something wrong with the Night Owl. I just can't prove it, that's all. I'm not smart enough. Just the guy they bring in to scare the other guy.
But when he says that, I don't. It doesn't make me cry, but it makes me. I'm always really proud of that because it's seeing your own life sort of get incorporated. It's in Elroy's book, but my angle of it, to see it incorporated in the film and then spit back out on the screen is a very strange thing. And no one, unless I told them, no one would ever know that. What it meant to me, you know. It's just a good line in a police movie, so it's probably that. When the film was done, Warner Brothers saw the film and said, "This is no one's going to want to see this," and they wouldn't give us a release date, and they wouldn't tell us how many prints they were going to go out on, and that was all up to them. The financier of the film couldn't sway that, and it's like you can't, if someone says they don't like a movie, you can't argue them into liking it. But we thought it was great. And Curtis finally said, can we send it to Cannes? Can we send it to the Cannes Film Festival and see if they'll take it? And Warner's, the people over there just laughed. And they said, Cannes, this film is never going to play at Cannes. They'll laugh us, you know, they'll look at it and just call and laugh. And Curtis said, well, what do you have to lose? Who's going to know? Just send it to him. And he stuck with that. And finally, they threw their hands up and they said, oh, okay, we'll send it to Cannes. And they sent a print. And a couple of days went by and Curtis called me and he said, well, he goes, they called from Cannes. He goes, not only are they taking it, but we're in competition and they love it. And it got all these incredible reviews at Cannes in all the foreign press, in British, French, German. And that's what made Warner is all of a sudden say, oh, this is, we like this movie. We're going to release it. It's good. And all the, we're going to release it in the fall because it's prestigious and all those things. It was kind of unbelievable. So the first really weird moment was being with Curtis and Cannes when they were all applauding at the end of the film. And we're just looking at each other like, dude. And then I think the last moment was at the Academy Awards. And again, Curtis was a big student of history. And it was at the Shrine Auditorium. I think it was the last time it was held at the Shrine Auditorium. And I'm not going to lie, we knew we were going to win the Academy Award. That was it. And, you know, and Curtis has passed away way too young. And he made a lot of great movies after L.A. Confidential. And in fact, Wonder Boys, to me, is my favorite movie of his. I like Wonder Boys better than I like L.A. Confidential. And I think 8 Mile is a tremendous film. In time, is going to be thought of as a great film. And what I'll always remember most of all is that Curtis wanted to be part of Hollywood history, and he forced his way in. And it was L.A. Confidential that did it. And he said something to me that night when we won. He said that for the rest of your life, Academy Award winner is going to be the adjective before your name. And I remember the first time I saw my name in print after that, and it said Academy Award winner Brian Helgeland. And it changed my life. That adjective changed my life. And for sure, we earned it. So that's the story of L.A. Confidential.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We've been hearing from Academy Award winner Brian Helgeland on his work adapting the James Ellroy novel L.A. Confidential for the big screen. Up next, Brian Helgeland looks back on his favorite projects informed by themes of identity and status. We pick up our discussion with Brian Helgeland speaking at the Austin Film Festival in 2015. So I want to sort of introduce everybody to how you found your way into screenwriting. I seem to remember you did it through horror, right? And how you broke in.
It's a dumb story, but I always loved movies since I was little, but never had any sense of that you could do it for a living. The first movie I ever saw was Dr. No. No, I'm sorry. It was Goldfinger. And it was at the drive-in. My dad wanted to go see it. And I laid in the back dash of the car and watched Dr. No, but it was Goldfinger. And saw the guy throw the hat. And I was kind of hooked on movies after that. But I never knew anyone made movies other than people acted in them. And I thought, in the back of my head, I thought all movies are made by Alfred Hitchcock. Because I had seen them on TV. And that was it. So I love movies. They're all made by Alfred Hitchcock. And I think I thought that till I was about 17, I think. And I'm from East Coast, from a town called New Bedford, which is a fishing town. And all my dad, my uncles, my grandfather had all been fishermen. So when I got out of college, I had an English degree and I couldn't find a job. When I couldn't find a job I wanted to do. So I went fishing, which I really liked, but it was cold in the winter and wet, and the second winter was coming up, and I knew I didn't want to be cold all winter. And I was going to maybe go down to Florida or someplace. I didn't know what to do with myself. And I was in a bookstore, and always had read a lot. And I was walking through the bookstore in the bottom in some nonfiction section. I just saw a book that said A Guide to Film School. And it was like God came down and shined a light on my head. And I thought, and I picked it up and started to thumb through it. And I thought, someone makes movies. You can make movies. And now I'm in my 20s. So it's not so funny as Alfred Hitchcock. But It was a revelation, and all the schools were in L.A., and it was warm. And I applied to several and got into one and started writing. But I wrote a script, so I had a screenwriting class, which I wasn't all that interested in, but it was a requirement. And you had to write half a script. That was the assignment, which seemed kind of stupid. And halfway through the class, I was halfway through already. And I said to the instructor, who was an old television writer, what do I do with this? And he said, well, you got time, keep writing it and try to finish it. And I finished it and at the end of the semester, and I think I got a B+. And I said, well, what do I do with it now? He said, I don't know. I don't have an agent. I can't get an agent. I don't know what to do with it. And he said, his agent had died, I think. And he said, there's a contest. Enter it in the contest. So I entered it in the contest. And I went home. And I went fishing for the summer. And my dad called. My dad got a hold of me and said, some contest has been calling. You won some contest. And I had missed, you know, they notify you when you're one of 40. And they notify you when you're one of 12. And I had missed all that because they didn't know where I was. And it got down to one of four, and it was put on by Nissan, and a very long answer. But it was at the DGA, so I went back to school in September, and it coincided with this thing, and I was second place, and Ernest Hemingway's niece was first place. So I thought that was okay. I lost to a Hemingway. That's all right. And they had a reception, and at the reception, a guy came up to me and said, do you have an agent? And again, I didn't even know what an agent was. And he said, and I said, no, I don't have an agent. He said, I'd like to be your agent. And he gave me a card, and he started trying to sell my scripts, my homework. And I sold my seventh script that I wrote. I wrote seven scripts, and I sold the seventh one, and it was called 976 Evil. For those of you too young to remember, 976 phone number was like you could call and get your horror scope on the phone. And that was the idea. And I sold it, and it got made. And next thing I knew, I was on a film set and watching. It was a joke, really.
Alfred Hitchcock wasn't there.
Yeah, Alfred. No, Freddy Krueger. Robert Englund directed it. And so that was the start. Uh-huh. And horror movies were a great way to get going then because no one wanted to write them. You know, I think I got like $5,000 for that script, and that was it.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this episode of our program, we've been hearing from Academy Award-winning filmmaker Brian Helgeland. This year marks the 20th anniversary of Helgeland's celebrated film, L.A. Confidential, which was adapted from the James Ellroy novel of the same name and directed by Academy Award winner Curtis Hanson. When we left off, Helgeland was describing his early career writing horror films.
So that led to, like, how did that beginning take you to L.A. Confidential, which was still a really early film for you?
Yeah, because then it became very apparent that I would only get hired to write horror movies. No one was interested in anything else. And I had an agent at the time. And I had a friend, his name is Manny Cotto, who's one of the executive producers of 24 now. And he's doing a lot of stuff. He was on Dexter. And anyways, very successful TV producer. And we were very good friends. And he was writing horror movies also. And we just got together one day and we said, we can't write horror movies anymore. We have to, like, and it was when Die Hard and all those movies were coming out. And we thought we have to become action movie directors. Writers. And we didn't know how to do it. And so we wrote a spec. And we decided we'd write a spec and reinvent ourselves. And it was, at the time, it was a very kind of notorious spec screenplay called The Ticking Man. And we wrote it and sold it for a lot of money, and it almost got made. We got into prep with Bruce Willis, and then it fell apart. And then the company that bought it went bankrupt, and not before the checks cleared, though. And that didn't happen. But all of a sudden, I was an action movie writer, and everything that was submitted to me was action movies and that kind of thing. And I didn't that didn't hold my interest that long. And then
I had always loved James Ellroy.
So you said last night that one of the themes that you are attracted by is identity. I mean, does LA Confidential fit into that
realm? Yeah, and that's why I was attracted to it. I think when you're doing a novel adaptation, it's not like you just come on and do it. You have to relate to it on some level. Like Mystic River, for example, I'm the same age as Dennis Lehane. We're both from, he's from Dorchester, South Boston. I'm from south of Boston. But all those neighborhoods and all those people he describes, I recognize, you know, I grew up with the exact same people. So I felt an affinity for it. And that's why I could write it. If I had been born and raised in Seattle, Washington or something, I might not have an affinity for it on some level. But LA Confidential, what I always liked was that it was everybody was not who they appear. Everyone was fighting who they were in a way, or trying to prove who they were as far as identity goes. So Russell Crowe, he's a detective in his heart, but everyone thinks he's a muscle man and a guy who comes in and, as he says, scares the shit out of the other guy. But he's a detective in his heart and wants to prove that. Kevin Spacey's a bad, crooked cop, but some little part of him wants to be good again. You know, my favorite line is when he says, don't try to do the right thing, you haven't had the practice.
Do you remember Buzz Meeks, Dudley?
A disgrace as a police officer. Straight D fitness reports from every CO he ever served under. What about him?
12 years ago, he was on a vice rouse with Dick Stensland. They questioned Pierce Patchett about a blackmail scam. Patchett had Sid Hudgens photographing prominent businessmen with hookers. Anyway, charges were dropped. Insufficient evidence. You were the supervising officer on that case, and I was wondering if you remember anything about it.
What's this all about, Goyo?
Part of it has to do with a murder. I've been working with Ed Exley on it.
You're a narco, Jack, not homicide. Since when do you work with Edmund Exley?
Well, it's a private investigation. I messed something up. I'm trying to make amends.
Don't start trying to do the right thing, boyo. You haven't had the practice.
So he's trying to fight who he is, and Exley is completely has a facade of one thing and it's really another thing. So I thought, I don't know if that's how Ellroy would describe it, but I that all appealed to me because I thought, I'm this dumb kid from this poor town. Especially Bud White, I identified with. And I really think I'm a writer, but everyone would laugh who I grew up with if I told them that. So I felt very, that's how I knew how to write that adaptation.
So how much of that dialogue, because I know there were changes clearly from the book to the film, and you know, it'd be interesting to hear how you made some of those choices, but how much of Ellroy's dialogue was actually the dialogue from the film?
I think a lot of it was. I couldn't tell you exactly. He has that abbreviated style that's very suited to film dialogue. So I always think dialogue in movies is poetry in a way, because it's like the biggest joke is when someone reads your script and says, this isn't how people talk in real life. Well, that, thank God, you know, because we don't have all the ums and the ahs and the incomplete sentences. But film dialogue is poetry because it has to be done so short and so to the point and not to the point at the same time. And his dialogue in this book is like that. And so if it isn't his dialogue or a version of it or a streamed down version of it, then it's me trying to get, and Curtis trying to get into the same rhythm as that dialogue. We don't know better than he does. But we sometimes are writing scenes that aren't in the book, and we try to be in the spirit of that dialogue and go into his flow rather than try to turn his flow into our flow.
So what is it that's in the movie that was not in the book that was sort of...
The thing I'm most proud of is if you've seen the movie, it's Rollo Tomasi. It's the Kevin Spacey, his character in the book is killed there's a train called the Q train, which transports prisoners to and from San Quentin prison. And there's a riot on that train and all these police are called in to deal with it. And Kevin Spacey, I think that's how he dies. Kevin Spacey gets on that train and gets killed. Not Kevin Spacey, but his character in the book. And we had to change all that because we had to have it all working around the night owl. So that whole thing with that he gets shot by the crooked police captain and dies and says that name, which is the name of the guy Ed Exley invents to describe who killed his dad. That's all an invention that I came up with to try to bridge all that stuff.
Have you a valediction, boyo?
Rollo. Tomasi.
And Elroy, who I'm friends with, said to, I had dinner with him one night, and he's like, if one more person comes up to me and tells me how much they loved the Rollo Tomasi scene in my book, I'm going to kill him. Because it's not in the book. But it's trying to take everything he did and bridge it and get it all towards that one thing, and we don't have the luxury. A novelist understands all that you have to take out and all the things you have to do and condense and all that, and they don't mind that. What they mind is if the movie doesn't have the same theme as the book. So as long as you're true to the thematics of the book, which we were, how you get there is up for grabs.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We continue our discussion with writer-director Brian Helgeland, looking back on the making of his film, A Knight's Tale, and the inspiration for the story. The film starred Paul Bettany and the late actor Heath Ledger.
On Knight's Tale, I had a whole thing of ideas of things I had aborted that I had tried to write and couldn't figure out how to do. And I had once come across that jousting was a medieval sport in many ways. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I never thought of that they had a sport back then. And it was jousting, a war sport. And I had done Payback, and I had a tough experience on that film at the end. And I was trying to think of a movie to do, and I didn't know what to do. And I started looking at old ideas, and I came across my notes on the jousting. And I thought, I like that idea. I wonder why I couldn't get anywhere with it. And I was looking through my notes, and one of the notes was you had to be of noble birth to compete. And I saw that, and I thought, so immediately the guy came to mind. It's a peasant who wants to be a knight, but he has to hide who he is to do it. And I thought, that's a screenwriter who wants to be a director. And that's how I wrote that whole script was all, it was really, it's the story of a screenwriter who wants to be a director. And I hid it all in the way I did it.
But you can't even joust.
Well, most of it is the guts to take a blow, to strike one. Guts I have. And technique? I have a month to learn that. Besides, the sword. Name a man better with the sword than I.
In the practice ring.
You're not of noble birth.
Well, so we lie. How did the nobles become noble in the first place, huh? They took it at the tip of a sword. I'll do it with a lance.
A blunted lance?
Oh, no matter what, a man can change his stars. And I won't spend the rest of my life as nothing.
That is nothing, and nothing is right where glory will take us.
We're the sons of peasants. Glory and riches and stars are beyond our grasp, but a full stomach, that dream can come true.
My theory is, especially in period old, when you get into medieval period films, it's like all anyone talks about is freedom. And not to pick on any movies, because there's great, great movies. You know, I love Braveheart. I love all these period films. But I'm like, is really, that's all anyone talks about? And that's all anyone, back in the 500 years ago, people talked about philosophy all day long and what it is to do this and be that. And especially in Chaucer, it's very funny. And people laugh. When someone farted in 1370, people laughed. And that was kind of one of the ideas behind it. Like, someone had given me a hard time because they called Geoffrey Chaucer Jeff in the film. And I said, well, what year were nicknames invented? Like 1911, nicknames were invented. And so I approached that story from, I want to do a movie set in the Middle Ages that doesn't have the freedom of a nation attached to it. Mm-hmm. And it's about this guy and his friends, just like it would be if I made about a guy and his friends today, but they happen to live in medieval Europe and all those things. And people are the same. and times change and technology changes, but people fall in love, they get mad at each other, they have rivals, is this or that. And the fact that the jousting was a medieval sport kind of reaffirmed all that for me, and it was just to have fun.
So how much did that Oscar affect you after?
This is my weekend. On Saturday, I got the Raspberry Award for the worst screenplay. And on Sunday was the Academy Awards. And I don't mean to sound, I'm just going to be honest. I don't mean to sound arrogant, but we had won every single award there was to be won for LA Confidential leading into the, except for the BAFTAs, which we lost to a Shakespeare play. But we had won everything. And I knew I was going to win the, I never even thought about it. I knew Hossein Amini, who wrote Wings of a Dove, who's had a very successful career. He'd always get nominated and I'd see him everywhere. And he'd always look at me and say, I don't know why I'm here. You're going to win. You know, it's a joke. But I knew we were going to win. I never thought we were going to do anything but win. I never was nervous about it. I was just waiting to get it. And when Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon gave the award, and I wasn't thinking, am I going to win? I just thought, I hope Walter Matthau gives me the award and not Jack Lemmon. Because I love Walter Matthau and I don't get Jack Lemmon. And please, please don't give it to me, Jack. And we won, and Jack gave Curtis his, and he was a hero of Curtis's, uh-huh. And Walter Matthau gave me mine, so thank you. And on Monday, the real thing was I was having trouble on Payback and Post, and I was refusing to do reshoots that they wanted to soften it. And I was close to getting fired because I was being so stubborn. And I thought to myself, when I win, they won't have the nerve to fire me. And when I got it, I was like, now they can't fire me off Payback. I'm not going to get fired off Payback. They can't fire a guy that just won the Academy Award. So I got the Raspberry for the worst film on Saturday. On Sunday, I won the Academy Award. On Monday morning, Paramount fired me off of Payback. So that's how winning an Academy Award helped me. So
what was the Razzie Award for?
The Postman.
The Postman.
Which I worked just as hard on The Postman as I did on LA Confidential. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you accept that award too?
I did accept it. Yeah, I did. And I got it. And there's a very funny thing. If you've seen The Postman, it's the Rainmaker, really, that movie. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who comes to town full of lies, and everyone believes it but him. And then at the end, he has to start believing his own lie. And what the big thing was is Costner at a certain point said, you know, this guy's really unsympathetic because he's lying to everybody. And I said, yeah, but that's the beauty of it. And then he changed it to that he kind of believes what he's saying. And it was, I always said, it was like if Burt Lancaster really believed he could make it rain, if you've seen that movie, if he really believed he could make it rain, it wouldn't be the movie it is. Mm-hmm. Or the play, I guess it was a play at first. But that was the difference, really, in the whole thing. And but I worked just as hard on that movie as any other movie ever. It's not like we set out to make a bad movie. Mm-hmm. I was personally very fortunate because I was, I had worked for Dick Donner, the director, on a couple of films that got made, on a bunch that didn't get made. And we were doing Conspiracy Theory, and I was unhappy with how it was coming out. And Dick stopped me one day. He was going to lunch. We were all going back to base camp to go to lunch. And he was in his golf cart, and he pulled up alongside me, and he was really mad at me. And he said, get in, and he started saying, you're unhappy with what I'm doing. And I said, no, I'm being a good writer. I'm like, no, I'm not unhappy. And he goes, yeah, just say you're unhappy. You can say you're unhappy. And I thought, well, okay, I'm about to get fired off this movie, so I might as well just say I'm unhappy. And I said I was. And he said something very important to me, which was that, you know, a director is not adversarial to a writer. He doesn't say, hey, there's a great script. How can I ruin it to make him miserable or her miserable? He just said, I have a different way of seeing the world than you do. And the thing you think is most important is only the third most important thing, I think. And I'm always going to, I can't direct this film if I'm not telling it through my own self. And if you want it to be the way you want it to be, then you have to be the one that gets to this point. And he didn't fire me. And I was like, let me try to make this what he needs it to be. I've made it, I've written it what I need it to be, and now I'm going to try to make it what he needs it to be, which is the way the world works. In a way, you got to know your place in it, and if you're unhappy with your place in it, then you got to try to find another place in it. But I mean, I would never say to anyone I wanted to be a writer in my hometown, and didn't know it for a long time, and didn't, and was embarrassed by it almost, because it's, to be a writer is an amazing thing. A lot of writing is just, I spend all day long thinking I'm an idiot. But it is identity in a way, and if there's truth to be had in the world and you want to write about it or dramatize it, you have to figure it out in yourself first.
Remember, dear readers, you heard it here first. Off the record, on the QT, and very hush, hush.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment of the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing from Brian Ramos, Jamal Knox, and Madeline Burgess. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more from the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.